This is Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll hear what Michael Perry has learned about working and writing by living in Wisconsin.
First, vaccination rates in Wisconsin lag behind other states, and the Medical College of Wisconsin wants to change that with a new program starting this month.
WPR health reporter Shemaine Mills joins us with the details. Shemaine, thanks for joining us today.
Glad to be here.
So why are people seeing a need to increase Wisconsin's vaccination rates? Why is this a priority?
Well, to get right to it, they're low, especially certain diseases like the seasonal flu. We don't vaccinate even half the population. And so there's an effort to boost that along with other vaccinations, like the more common ones, measles, mumps, rubella, polio. We aren't as low in those shots, mainly because you have to get them to go to school. But we do see lower rates for toddlers and preschoolers for that 7 series of shots.
So the rates overall are low. And how do we compare, do we know, to other states?
Well, when you take a look at the flu, no state reaches what the CDC would like, which is 70% vaccination.
And where do we end up in Wisconsin on the flu?
The flu, we're at 44%.
So way under that CDC recommendation.
Right. And it's not like we're an outlier. As I said, most states fall short of the 70%.
Are there specific demographic groups that are lagging behind more than others?
Well, I talked to the dean of the pharmacy school at the Medical College of Wisconsin, and he said Black and Hispanic seniors tend to be lagging on tetanus and pneumococcal, so pneumonia. All groups lag behind on flu, as we talked about, and shingles, that's for older adults, not a lot of vaccination there. Plus, anyone who doesn't have a doctor. I mean, that's how many of these people are reminded or told to get shots. And there's a substantial population that just doesn't have a primary care doctor.
And that leads to this new approach you talked to the Medical College of Wisconsin about. What are they trying to do, especially for that group?
Well, they want to expand immunization, basically go to where people are. And a number of people go to drugstores for other things, their customers. So the thinking is if they're in there to buy something, maybe we could get them a shot, whether it's for the flu or HPV. And state law does allow this. So pharmacists already give shots for the flu in my neighborhood. Mm-hmm. I don't know how widespread
it is. Mine
too.
Yeah, I see that around. Yeah.
So the thinking is maybe we could train them to give other shots.
And would they be able to vaccinate anyone, or are there limits as to who a pharmacist is able to give a vaccine to?
Well, theoretically, they could vaccinate anyone. But realistically, if you have a small child, you're going to the pediatrician. Mm-hmm. Your pediatrician is going to tell you what shots you need, and you most likely are going to get it there. If you're elderly, you probably have an established relationship with the doctor. He or she is going to tell you what shots you need. You're going to get them there. But there are a number of people, like I said, who do not have a primary care physician, and so they might go to a pharmacist and get these shots.
Now, the Medical College of Wisconsin is working on this. I assume that we're not going to wake up one day and every pharmacist in every town is offering vaccinations. How are they trying to roll this out?
Well, it starts in January, but it's going to take some time. First of all, there's a number of pharmacists who may need training. And then there's the question of, do they want to offer this? How are they going to get reimbursed? There's all sorts of questions. And then they still have to find out what demographics, what neighborhoods have low vaccination rates. And how do you go into these communities and try and persuade them this is a shot you may want to consider getting? So there's a lot of work to be done before we see widespread shots at drugstores.
And is the idea that they would pilot this maybe in some of those neighborhoods with low vaccination rates?
Right. Before they do that, they'll probably roll it out at the satellite campuses of the Medical College of Wisconsin. So we're talking Wausau is one of them. And because they're affiliated with the college, they have a working relationship. So,
and is anybody voicing concerns about this? This is a little bit different way of doing things when it comes to vaccines.
Well, not publicly, but I reached out to the Wisconsin Medical Society, and they said, no, we're on board with this because we want to see people vaccinated. Mm-hmm. It's a public health concern. We want protection against those diseases. But they have some caveats. First of all, they want to make sure that it's entered into the Wisconsin immunization records. So the left hand knows what the right hand's doing. If your druggist gives you a shot, does your physician know if you have a physician? And they want to make sure these people are trained. You know, whoever's giving the shot knows how to do it.
And that's huge for kids in particular, because I know as a parent, if you want to send your kid to school, you have to have that up-to-date vaccination record. So that's an important hurdle to overcome, it sounds like.
Right. And there we've seen an increase in the number of kids who ask for an exemption. Mm-hmm. And it gets to the point where public health officials are concerned because they want as many people protected as possible. Some people can't get shots. And so it's important for those who can get shots to have that immunity. And so they actually put out a map online showing the vaccination rates for these school shots. And it varies greatly across the state.
So this effort from the medical college to boost vaccinations by working in drugstores, I know it's early, it hasn't even started yet, but do they have an idea of what success looks like?
Well, of course, they'd like to see fewer vaccine-preventable diseases. Mm-hmm. Whether they'll be able to achieve that in 30 months is unlikely. They'd like to boost the vaccination rates. But I think it just getting pharmacists thinking about this and laying the groundwork for increasing what they call the medical home, basically getting care in different places, because everybody's working towards the same goal, try and get people healthy, get them the shots they need. There are problems with convenience and logistics. Not everyone has a doctor, can make it to a doctor, that kind of thing.
All right, we'll leave it there. Chimene, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
Chimene Mills covers health news for WPR. She joined us to talk about a new effort sponsored by the Medical College of Wisconsin that aims to increase vaccination rates around the state.
Coming up, Wisconsin author Michael Perry joins us for a chat about his collection of essays that focuses on work and what he's learned from the various jobs he's held.
Stay with us here on Central Time. You are listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Our next guest knows a thing or two about getting work done, from his time as a volunteer firefighter to his current gigs as a writer, newspaper columnist, musician, and host of Tent Show Radio. Michael Perry just might be one of the hardest working guys in Wisconsin. And that theme of work figures prominently in his new collection of essays.
Michael Perry is the author of Population 485 and Truck, A Love Story, among others. One of his most recent books is Danger, Man Working, Writing from the Heart, the Gut, and the Poison Ivy Patch. Michael, thanks for joining us today.
Hey, great to be here.
Now, writers have a lot of metaphors for how they do their work. You've got one that I've never come across before involving some shovel time. Can you talk about what shoveling manure has to do with your writing process?
Yeah, I think the first time I invoke this was way back when I wrote the book Population 485, but I've recently revisited it with this collection that I've just had come out because it's truly a collection of freelance work. But I've always said, people ask me, well, how does a farm kid with no writing background from rural Wisconsin make it as a writer? And I said, the only thing I know about surviving as a freelance writer is I learned everything I needed to know from cleaning my dad's calf pen, which is you just keep shoveling until you got a pile so big someone has to notice. And over time, I've tuned it a little bit. Like, obviously, I deployed a pitchfork more than a shovel, but I say I know an apt metaphor when I accidentally stick it with a pitchfork. But yeah, pretty much that's it. Just keep shoveling.
You know, though, I think part of why people in Wisconsin like you is they might hear that and think, well, why shouldn't a young guy from rural Wisconsin become a writer? Like, it seems like we've specialized writing to something that you go to New York to do.
Yeah, that brings to mind so many thoughts. I don't know if I can keep track of them all. But in the first place, yes, we recently did a stage adaptation of Population 485. And I talk in there about my friend Barry Lynn, the dancer, who lives in rural Rusk County, Wisconsin. Well, it's not like there really is only rural Rusk County, mm-hmm. Wisconsin. But I talk about him having a dance studio out there and doing beautiful things. And I said, you know, the only reason you would think that that's unusual is if you think art belongs somewhere else. And I think art belongs wherever it happens. Also, it does set up a tricky thing, too. I'm not at all anti the academy. Some of my most meaningful and helpful and essential mentors have MFAs and teach at universities. It's just that idea that you don't have to be from one particular place, that you can be a roughneck and still appreciate beauty. And I think, you know, the country itself is a reflection of the damage that happens when we decide we have to just be one thing or the other. I read about taking my daughters to the Shakespeare Festival on Wednesday and to the Demolition Derby on Friday, and we had a great time at both places.
You know, it seems like there's almost a movement here, because when you think about musicians in Eau Claire, and I've talked to some from Janesville who say, you know, they're motivated by farmscapes and landscapes in Wisconsin. We've talked to Max Garland, the former poet laureate in the state, who really finds a lot of his inspiration in the nature and, again, agricultural land of Wisconsin. And then there's you. I mean, we got a thing here, don't we?
We do, although I'm careful with that, too, because I grew up on a dairy farm in rural Wisconsin, so red barns, green fields, black and white cows, that's my Wisconsin. But in traveling around the state, it's always healthy for me to be reminded that Milwaukee is also every bit Wisconsin. I forget often, because I'm a flatland farm boy, that we have a great maritime history and character. So where I absolutely agree that you do draw from your surroundings, and Wisconsin is a rich place to do that. I just always want to be careful that I'm remembering all the different dimensions of it. But yeah, I think about in Eau Claire, you know, I when I go to Eau Claire, I always say I can walk into the coffee shop, or I can walk into the joint, a bar downtown, and if I need someone to hang drywall, there they are. If I need someone to master an album, there they are.
And you and work inspires a lot of the essays in this new book. It's not just about work, but that's been a big part of your life. Writer and rancher and nurse and musician and a lot of different stuff. What kind of perspective have all these jobs given you over time?
I'd say two things off the top of the head. One is just a deep gratitude that I've found something that I love to do. The first thing I want to do when I get up in the morning is write, and I can't believe I'm allowed to do that. And I never forget that it's a supreme privilege. On the other hand, I just have that healthy dose of knowing that it's just work. You're going to work. The book Man Working, I mean, the reason I called it that is, or it's actually called Danger Man,
right?
Working, because there's a lot of humor about my own incompetencies in there. But, you know, I got a call one day from an editor, and he said, can you climb Mount Rainier? And I just said, yes. I didn't know if I could climb Mount Rainier, but that's the only answer. And then I wound up climbing with two veterans who had been horribly injured in the Iraq War. And that story is not about me. The story is about them. If you read the story, you don't even know I'm there. But that's a case of where it's not about me being all artful, it's about showing up, and now we've kind of circled back to just cleaning those calf pens. My brother's a logger. He goes out and logs. He doesn't get any awards. No one claps for him. He just gets up, and that's what he does. And so it's that fine line. I don't want to sound too cornbone, but the truth is I am lucky to do what I do, and I do just approach it with a blue-collar sensibility.
Talking to Michael Perry, his latest book is Danger, Man Working. And you mentioned, you have a sense of your own limitations. And as you go back over these essays, you have little notes about them where this last line I was kind of embarrassed by. What is it like to have a kind of a this is your life in writing over the last 15 years as you put this together?
Pros and cons. It can be pretty bracing. I mean, part of it is, for instance, when I reread that piece about climbing Mount Rainier with those soldiers, sometimes my greatest privilege, it certainly isn't in telling my story, it's in being trusted to tell the story of someone else. And again, as a farm kid from rural Chippewa County, I just can't believe that I got to do something like that. On the flip side, you're right, there are parts in there, there are some lines where I'm not even trying to be funny here, there are some lines I wrote that I'm not very proud of. And I could have changed them, I could have excised them, but I thought, you know what, I'm going to leave them and own up to them and say, you know, the news here is that perhaps we can change over time, and I hope for the better. It seems like we all hit a stage where we either dig our heels in and fight every change coming down the pike, or we open ourselves up to the idea that new things are coming and they'll be okay too. And so some of the stuff, yeah, it makes you cringe a little bit, but I think in the name of honesty, you leave it there. But all in all, I just, yeah, going through a collection like that, which has got everything in there from, you know, a letter I wrote posthumously to Lightnin' Hopkins about my daughter, to very straightforward pieces that I wrote for Men's Health. The main thing is it just reinforces to me that for me, writing has been a means to an adventure, and I feel like a guy who got on the wrong bus, but it's a great bus.
Well, speaking of not cringing, it was a little hard. You have a piece on puking. A very up close and kind of only Michael Perry could have written it piece on vomiting. How'd you get there?
Well, That comes to paying the rent. I was I had done some work with Men's Health magazine, and then I can't remember if I got sick or somewhere along the line. I also, you know, people throw up a lot when I do a lot of volunteer firefighting EMT stuff, or have over the years, and still do make a handful of calls a year. And puke is kind of a universal response to a lot of things. And so somewhere in there, I thought, well, I'd like to really learn about what makes us puke and how does that work. And so I got the assignment, and you're right, really went in depth on perhaps more than people want. But, you know, someone's got to do puke research.
Well, and, you know, when we see the TV shows, we see the first responders of various sorts. They're often featured, and they're the heroes. And you're right. You know, there's a lot of this being an EMT and other first responder jobs, not all that glamorous.
No, I would. As a matter of fact, I'd say the bulk of it. You just show up. You try to help people. And sometimes it's as simple as holding somebody's hand. Sometimes it's as simple as helping them find their nitroglycerin. And then there are those times when it is a complete throwdown and you're opening airways and you're stopping bleeding and you're doing all those things you were taught to do, and you're doing them under duress and in very difficult circumstances. And but yeah, a lot of the times you're just showing up and doing the basics.
Looking ahead, Michael, generally every time I talk to you, I get the sense this guy's busy. What do you have now?
I have a book that I'm pretty nervous about. It's a book called Montaigne in Barn Boots. And it's about me reading the philosopher Montaigne, and I would say reflecting on my thoughts about him, but I'm not really, more like rebounding and slam dunking and chewing over and trying to figure out Montaigne. And it's got me a little nervous just because I'm in over my head, but then that's the whole point of the book. And B, I go into some areas that I've not gone before. On the other hand, there's plenty of essays in there about me feeding my chickens too.
Should the rest of us pick up a Montaigne? Is it worth confronting even if we feel like we're in over our heads?
Oh, sure, yeah. Montaigne was great. I mean, for one thing, it is generally agreed, not universally, but generally agreed that he invented the essay form, and I wouldn't be able to make a living if he hadn't invented that, so I'm pretty grateful to him. But the thing I love about Montaigne is, you know, we kind of started this conversation talking about this false divide between high and low culture, or you're just a regular person or you're an intellectual. Well, Montaigne was a privileged nobleman of his time, but he also wrote essays about everything from the Greek gods and philosophy to how your thumb works and the danger of riding horses in the wrong way, and he wrote about sex and life and everything in between. And so, he's very approachable, no matter your background.
Michael, always good to talk to you. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. We'll talk to you down the road.
Michael Perry is a writer, newspaper columnist, musician, and host of Tent Show Radio. We talked to him about his most recent books, Danger at Man Working, Writing from the Heart, the Gut, and the Poison Ivy Patch, and Montaigne in Barn Boots.
In 2011, black youth in Dane County were 15 times more likely to spend time in jail than white youth. And once kids get into the system, that can lead to challenges that ripple throughout their lives.
As Bridget Bowden reports, one program in Madison is aiming to curb those numbers by introducing kids to art.
The program is called Making Justice, and today they're making pizza.
So take a piece of dough, find a spot, and I will...
Making Justice is an art program for kids who've had contact with the justice system. It's run by Madison Public Library, where Jesse View is a teen services librarian.
By definition, teenagers are at risk. And so all teenagers in my philosophy are at risk because, that's when you take chances, and we all did.
Making Justice started in 2013 and now serves about 500 kids each year. The goal is to provide a platform for them to express themselves, learn new skills, and meet potential mentors. Kids across the county participate in the program, including those in the Dane County Juvenile Detention Center.
The most basic outcome is to have tried something new, and know whether or not you like it based on experience and not just word of mouth or reading about it or, making assumptions.
Today's group meets once a week, and the kids were referred to Making Justice by the court. At the end of the program, they'll put on an art show. Surprise is a high school junior. She says she's tried a lot of new things in the class.
Working with people and getting to learn stuff you didn't think it was possible to learn. Like art. I hate art. And when you bring art in me, it won't work. But I did it. So, yeah.
And in this class, pizza is considered art.
Art to me can be gardening, it can be cooking, painting, screen printing, you know, it can be so many different things.
That's local artist Carlos Gacharna, one of the program's partners. He grew up in Madison and says he took some risks when he was younger.
Police officers, that kind of thing, could have sent me down a different path, but decided not to.
He says he could have easily been in the same situation as the kids in the program, but he got lucky.
So what I'm hoping to do is kind of like, so many of the kids that I see are on the edge. So if I can just pull them back before they get into one of those situations where you might not get lucky, then, you know, hopefully I did a good job.
In addition to making pizza, the kids get a lesson about anthropology. They learn that food is one of the best ways to learn about other cultures. Gacharna says he tries to make the classes about more than just what they're making.
To me, art is a vehicle to teach about a whole bunch of stuff. So I get to teach about culture, I get to teach about science, I get to teach about history, about elements of design. So in a sense, it's a vehicle to teach about, you know, about expanding learning in general.
Gacharna and the other partners have a great rapport with the kids. They play the music they like. They make jokes. You might even say they're cool. When sixth grader Tremaine's pizza collapses on its way to the oven, Gacharna helps him fix it.
We had a pizza turn calzone back into a pizza.
I'm kind of angry and happy at the same time. Now I created a new thing.
For Gacharna, making justice is about more than just the skills they're teaching.
I feel like we're on the front lines of dismantling the school-to-prison pipeline.
He says art and good mentors were what made the difference for him, and he hopes it's the same for the kids in the program. Bridget Bowden, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up after the news, we'll look at whether we've sacrificed biodiversity for having reliable access to just a few varieties of fruits and vegetables that travel well. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Rob Farad. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Rob Farad. Coming up, we take a look back at the year in weather, and it was one for the record books.
First, go into any grocery store in the U.S. any time of the year, and you can be pretty sure that you can find a banana, and that it will look and taste like the last banana you bought, and like the next one, too.
Unless you're buying directly from local producers, that's true of a lot of the fruits and vegetables that we eat and depend on. And while consistency and year-round availability might seem like signs of scientific advancement, they can also show a loss of genetic diversity and risks to our global food supply.
Rob Dunn has traced crashes in food crops, as well as the efforts of scientists to prevent further catastrophes. He's a professor of applied ecology at North Carolina State University. His book is titled Never Out of Season: How Having the Food We Want When We Want It Threatens Our Food Supply and Our Future. Rob, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thanks so much, Judith. Great to be on the show. That was a great intro.
Oh, well, thank you very much. And I'm sure it's going to be a great conversation because this is really a fascinating book. How did you decide to explore threats to agricultural diversity?
Well, so I started my career focused on forest recovery in the Amazon, and so I worked on these old fields that were abandoned because of various disasters. I was looking at old cacao fields that had collapsed, old cassava fields that had collapsed. And so I'd been thinking for much of my career about the interactions that set the stage for those sorts of collapses. And it just finally started to come together that these were the same kinds of stories that I'd been dealing with when we study what lives on human bodies or what lives in houses, that they're all stories about the complex ecology that links us to other species. And so I just became fascinated with it and couldn't turn away. So then it became a book.
There are so many stories that illustrate your concerns, but let's take an example that actually might explain a lot of our listeners actually being in this state, being in this country. That's the potato and the tragedy that affected the Irish. What happened there?
Well, I mean, it's a fascinating story. So the potato is Andean, and in the Andes, there were more than 1,000 varieties of potatoes and other root and tuber crops. And the conquistadors brought some back, and they got to the Canary Islands. And then of those that the conquistadors took, a couple of varieties became popular in Northern Europe and in Ireland. And they were amazing. People could feed a whole family just on potatoes and milk. And in Ireland, that became the mainstay for the vast majority of people, which was a heroic sort of moment in modern agriculture, the ability to eat just one thing and still be really healthy. But it set the stage for a collapse unlike anything anybody had ever seen before. And what happened was that a pathogen, something called the oomycete, which is we used to think of as a fungus, but really it's its own branch of life, showed up in continental Europe, and people started to bicker about what caused it. And everybody hoped it would never get to Ireland because the Irish were so dependent on the potato. But this was a time when nobody understood germ theory very well. And so nobody really knew what a pathogen was in general, much less what this thing was that was making the potatoes sick. And so while the scientists bickered, this thing called the late blight got to Ireland and over a series of years would proceed to wipe out potato fields and with it people's livelihoods. And so in the end, over 1 million Irish died and nearly as many Irish emigrated. And it changed the makeup of the United States and started really our modern obsession with monoculture. We learned almost the exactly wrong lesson from the story.
Well, and what I found really interesting is things that were collected in the Andes, there are hundreds of varieties of what we would refer to as a potato, but you know they're very distinct. They have very distinct qualities, growing conditions, but it was one particular kind of potato that became so popular in Ireland, and so basically every potato was susceptible to the same things.
Yeah, that's right. This is the way we farm almost everything now. You know, we find the variety that makes a lot of whatever we want, and we plant that everywhere. And that has lots of benefits. And in Ireland, before the famine, it had tons of benefits. More people could exist on the same amount of land than could otherwise. But it also has this cost. And the other thing to me that's fascinating about the potato example is I think we imagine that some wise person out there is choosing the perfect varieties of each of these things for us on our behalf. But there's a lot of idiosyncrasy, too. And so the kind of potato that became popular in Ireland, you know, the initial filtering that got it to Europe, it was just a bunch of hungry, stinky conquistadors who were sort of grabbing what they could find. And so there was never a moment, there never has been a moment when somebody's gone, oh, what would be the best varieties for us to have? Which things do we want? Which ones are resistant? And so we're still really beholden to these weird idiosyncratic histories of hundreds of years ago.
So how did we get to the point where, as we said in the introduction, you can go into any grocery store, any day of the year, any season, and get what is immediately identifiable as a banana? And why are they so consistent from day to day, from year to year, from store to store?
Well, the banana story is really, I mean, it's almost identical in many features to the potato story, that, you know, once except that it has this transport component, you know, so the potatoes were being eaten locally, the bananas get transported, but for most of the history of the banana, people ate a bunch of local varieties of bananas. Bananas were domesticated in Papua New Guinea, moved through tropical Asia. But then it became clear that there was potentially a market in temperate places like the U.S. and Europe if you could get bananas to the table, but you had to ship them somehow. And so the nascent banana industry was on the lookout for something you could plant a lot of. You could put it on a boat. You could get it to New Jersey and New York and the U.S. And so they found this variety of banana that was sort of perfectly shippable. It was not remotely the most tasty or the most nutritious or anything, but it would grow well and you could ship it. And that was called the Gros Michel. And so in the 1940s and early 50s, that banana was planted throughout Central America at a scale so grand that it was almost like a country of bananas. And they were all planted clonally, so no seeds. And so they were all identical. And so, like, if you went and sampled a Gros Michel in Ecuador and you sampled one in Panama, they were more similar to each other than a cell in your toe would be to a cell in your eye. And so for shipping and for eating and for always having the same banana, it was perfect. It was just what consumers wanted. It was just what industry wanted. But, of course, it was just like the potato famine, too. And so if any pathogen could ever find the Gros Michel, it was in trouble. And that's just what happened. And so once again, we planted a monoculture. The pathogen caught up, and the pathogen wiped out the Gros Michel.
And now we have, I believe it's the Cavendish banana?
Yeah, and so the industry panicked, industry searched the world, and industry got lucky and found something that looked more or less like the Gros Michel but tastes quite a bit different, and did exactly the same thing with that. And so now the Cavendish is planted in many of those same countries the Gros Michel was planted in, and it too is susceptible to a bunch of different pathogens, and so there are now several that threaten to wipe it out. And so we do this again and again, but you know, we love to have these foods that look the same, and we love for them to be really cheap. And so that combined with the tendencies of industry favor these big monocultures.
So what, Rob, is lost when plants are grown in other places than where they originated? And so they're without their usual complementary species present?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, one of the things that happens is we get escape. And so you take a banana that has pests and pathogens in Papua New Guinea and you move it to the Americas, and it escapes those pathogens, and so it grows much better. But the other piece, and so that's also part of what makes it so devastating when they catch up, but the other piece is that our crops also escape their beneficial species. And so cassava is really interesting in this regard. Manioc, it's the plant that makes tapioca. But is also the main sustenance for hundreds of millions of people in the tropics. So it's native to the Americas, very near to the place in Bolivia where I used to work, but moved to Africa, moved to tropical Asia. And when it did, it escaped almost all of its pests and pathogens, but then one of those caught up, a cassava mealybug, and threatened basically to wipe out cassava. And the eventual solution to this, which is a pretty amazing story in and of itself, was to find a parasitoid, a wasp, that lays its eggs inside the body of that mealybug and then eats it from the inside out, which then has saved cassava. That wasp is spread across Africa. But because we didn't study cassava in its native range, we didn't know about that wasp, and we left it behind. And so we do that with lots of things. You know, chocolate. We actually don't know what pollinates chocolate in the Amazon, which is a crazy sort of thing. How could we not know? And yet much of these things we could study about our crops, nobody's ever studied because we're really focused on today, tomorrow, you know, how are we going to get more bananas, more wheat for the next week?
We're talking with Rob Dunn about his book titled Never Out of Season, How Having the Food We Want, When We Want It, Threatens Our Food Supply and Our Future. Rob's a professor of applied ecology at North Carolina State University.
And we want to know what you're thinking. Does the seeming lack of seed diversity worry you if you're a farmer or a gardener? Do you plant different varieties, maybe heirloom varieties of some of these fruits and vegetables? Let us know with an email at ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at @CentralTimeWPR.
We'll pick up the conversation after this short break. Stay with us here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson. We're picking up our conversation now with scientist Rob Dunn about his book, Never Out of Season, How Having the Food We Want, When We Want It, Threatens Our Food Supply and Our Future.
And we want to hear from you. Do you give much thought to how we're able to have so many fruits and vegetables available year-round? Does it worry you that we have such a small amount of diversity in what we eat? What steps would you as a consumer be willing to take if it would help address these issues? Maybe paying a little more? Share your thoughts by emailing ideas at WPR.org or tweet us at CentralTimeWPR.
So, Rob, we could go on and on talking about different examples of this with rubber, with cacao, as you mentioned. But I want to focus in on the people who have been working against time to prevent future crises from occurring. And one story that was just really gripping is that of Nikolai Vavilov. Can you tell us about him?
Yeah, Vavilov is an amazing guy. He was a Russian scientist who became fascinated with the diversity of crops around the world. And he came into science at a time when sort of Mendelian genetics and Darwinian evolution were starting to be integrated. And there was this sense of a powerful new approach to thinking about how we breed crops and what might be next. But Vavilov recognized that whatever we were going to do in the future, we needed to have as many varieties of crops from around the world as sort of the raw material with which to work to do that. And so he set about traveling the world to understand where's the greatest diversity of crops, how could he collect them, what was the traditional knowledge around those crops, and then he set about planting them in different parts of Russia to understand which of those varieties of crops were best for drought, which were best for pathogens, in order to set the stage for a grand project that he really imagined would not last his lifetime, but instead, you know, hundreds of years or maybe longer. And so it's to him that we owe a huge debt in terms of understanding, you know, where are the hot spots of varieties of wheat, of chili peppers, of chocolate, of all of these other things that we need to make sure we save. And so if that was his whole story in and of itself, it would be, I think, pretty heroic. But apropos of our elements of our own time, he fell afoul of a Soviet government that was not supportive of science and supported a sort of counterfactual approach to science based on a guy named Lysenko. And so Vavilov initially became marginalized, and then during the war he became imprisoned. In theory, he was imprisoned for his, you know, radical views and propaganda against the country. In practice, it was really for doing science. And so the war starts, and his sort of tragic story then unfolds from that moment. And what happens to him, I think, is both humbling relative to our current global moment and where science sits in society, and maybe emboldens one to make sure to do the work that needs to be done.
Well, and talk about heroes. So there was Vavilov himself, but then there was his whole crew of scientists who, when World War II was really threatening the places where these seeds were saved and these seed potatoes were saved, they gathered them all in Leningrad, and literally some of them die at their desks surrounded by bags of rice that they could have been eating, but they were so committed to the preservation of these seeds for future generations that they couldn't even bring themselves to eat it when literally their lives were on the line.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And I mean, I think about that all the time. It was actually quite hard to write about. I mean, just this or last week, there's a collection in Louisiana that was threatened, not of seeds, but of plants and insects and all sorts of other things. And we're always, as scientists, sort of fighting to keep these kinds of collections going. And, you know, they're not so expensive in the big scheme of things, but they need to be tended to. And then we look back at, you know, Vavilov's workers, and there they are in the collection dying for the same sort of cause that, you know, I think at the end of the day, oh, do I have time to do something else on behalf of that collection? But boy, it's really something, and yeah, it gives me a lot of pause and gives me the shivers thinking about it. But to those people, we owe many of the varieties that would resuscitate Russian agriculture after the war. And there's not a very good tally, but most people suspect some of the varieties that are being used in agriculture around the world. And so you may eat the consequences of that heroic story.
We're talking with Rob Dunn about his book, Never Out of Season, How Having the Food We Want When We Want It Threatens Our Food Supply and Our Future. Let's go to the phones now, and Don in DeForest is up. Hi, Don.
Hi. I was particularly struck by how much our food has changed and their efforts to keep food, oranges orange and bananas yellow and viable in cross-country shipments or around-the-world shipments. We now have the oranges, but I no longer eat them because they are flavorless. They're juicy, and that's about it. That strawberries fell to this horrible thing 10, 15 years ago, and just in the last few years, I've noticed that blueberries now are becoming the next juicy, flavorless item on the tack.
Thanks for that call, Don. And Rob, certainly that's something that I've noticed as well. Have we basically sacrificed the enjoyment of eating for consistent supply?
Yeah, I mean, I think globally that's a big part of this story. I think locally there are lots of exciting, you know, things going on where people are, And if they have the means, investing a little more money in heritage varieties of crops and things at farmers markets with special flavors and, locally grown things that grow where people are. But for sure, the main global story is that we're eating fewer and fewer kinds, species of crops. And of those crops, the varieties we're eating, they grow a lot. They ship well. They don't have very much flavor, and when you grind them up, they make good processed food.
So, Rob, are there still areas in the world where there is still considerable diversity?
Yeah, absolutely, and I think it can change very fast within a region. And so, I mean, to take a couple of good news stories, in Mérida, in Mexico, Mexico has an amazing agricultural heritage, and in Mérida there are now farmers markets that specialize in local heritage varieties of crops. And there's really now a food scene there that emphasizes traditional varieties, traditional flavors, traditional knowledge thereof. And so, you know, that's the kind of thing, if when we have the chance to support markets like that, it's great. Similar example in the Andes, there's now a national park that focuses on conserving, you know, not necessarily wild places, but instead farmers farming traditional varieties of potatoes. And, you know, that's a resource for people in the Andes, but it's also a resource for all of us when we need those. And so the same is true. Ethiopia still has a lot of amazing heritage crops that we don't see very often. And then there are places that, you know, if you look 20 years ago, there wouldn't have been much, but now there's been a renewed sort of resuscitation of those crops. And so in Scandinavia, the focus on new Nordic cuisine and figuring out, well, what are the Scandinavian crops, what are our heritage varieties, has really triggered a reinvestment in the farming of those varieties. And you see them in stores now in a way that you didn't used to. And so I think those kinds of examples are hopeful. For sure, the dominant, you know, grocery store counterexample is less hopeful, but I think we can make big changes, and I think the important thing to remember is you can make a local change that has a really big impact on the overall story. And so what you purchase, what you grow, is really important in this. The other part too that's interesting to me is that very often we know very little about these crops, even though we imagine otherwise. And so in my lab, we're trying to figure out ways for the public to help us and studying some of these crops.
Rob, thank you so much for spending time with us.
Thank you so much, Judith. Wonderful program. Have a great day.
You too. Rob Dunn is the author of Never Out of Season, How Having the Food We Want When We Want It Threatens Our Food Supply and Our Future.
crowdfunding is a pretty popular way to raise funds for just about anything. There have been campaigns out there to get a band's CD produced, an inventor's design put into production, even to help a friend facing big medical bills.
Well, here's one that I haven't seen before, but I have to say I love it. 7,500 people contributed to a fund to buy a 13th century chateau in the French countryside, complete with moat.
And it was a really successful campaign. The minimum share was 60 euros. And in just 40 days, the site raised the 500,000 euros it needed to buy it. That's about 600,000 bucks.
So they weren't really buying a share in the castle. They don't get to stay there as a vacation spot, sadly. But what they will get is the satisfaction of knowing that the castle will get much needed renovations and repairs done.
And I guess movie and TV companies are saying, hey, maybe when you get this fixed up a little, we can look at filming there.
So that'll bring in some money, too. And, you know, we watch a lot of French movies and TV, so I'm definitely going to be watching for some in the next few years, see if they're using it.
No, I didn't crowdfund this, but it would be kind of cool to say, yeah, I am the owner of a French chateau in the countryside,
right,
along with 7,500 other people.
Well, and the nice thing is they do actually get to go visit parts of the castle. So there is a little benefit. But, you know, maybe we should broadcast from there sometime.
Well, from our remote chateau, this is Central Time on the Ideas Network.